Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. At long last, for fans of William Manchester's biographies of Winston Churchill, there is a third and final volume. It covers the period from World War II until Churchill's death in 1965. But William Manchester wrote only a small part of the book. Before he died in 2004, he asked his friend Paul Reed to finish it for him. The book is titled The Last Lion, Winston Churchill, Defender of the Realm. Biographer Paul Reed joins me in the studio to talk about the story of writing this extraordinary book. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you, Paul. It's good to have you here.
Good morning, Diane. Happy to be here.
Paul, this project came to you, took over your life in ways that you probably never could have imagined. Tell us how it began.
I think it would have to begin with my first meeting Bill Manchester in 1998. I went up to Middletown, Connecticut, with five of his old Marine buddies. His wife had died. He had had two strokes. And I went up to do a feature story. I knew one of the old Marines, Mac Douglas. He was a Baptist preacher in West Palm Beach. And I accompanied them up, and they went up there to buck up Bill to, you know, try to boost his feelings. And we spent a weekend together, and I was the fly on the wall taking notes, and Bill was very welcoming. One night, I'll never forget this, a young woman knocked on the door, 10:30 at night, student from Wesleyan. She had two copies of his books, or two of his books, and she wanted to ask him to inscribe them for her father, who was a veteran. This is 10:30 at night. He invited her in, sat her down, signed the books, and then she listened to these old Marines talking about Okinawa till well after midnight.
Wow.
So I wrote my story, and then another and another. My editor loved the features on veterans that I did.
Were you a veteran yourself?
No. My father went to the Naval Academy, and I grew up in the late 50s and early 60s with a lot of naval history percolating through the house. And that's where my interest in World War II naval history came about a long time ago. I'm not going to say how many years, more than 20. So I over the next five or so years, I'd visit Bill. My daughter was at UMass. My son lived with his mother on Long Island, and Middletown was close by, and we became friends and watched Red Sox games together and chatted.
In the chats that you had with him, did you have a sense that he was struggling with a manuscript or to create that third volume?
I think the struggle had taken place before I met him. The 10 years between 1988, when he began the third volume, and 1998, when he had the strokes. And he wrote a note to his son, I think, in 1985, that he was, you know, laid low by writer's block. He had
serious
medical...
Serious writer's block.
It stopped him.
It stopped him.
Now, he took, this is remarkable, a vacation from The Last Lion to write A World Lit Only by Fire in 1990-91. And, you know, it's a brief, light, fun romp through medieval Europe. That was his rest and relaxation.
And he thought that that might help him regain that momentum for the third volume.
He did, but it didn't. And by the time I met him, the strokes actually resulted in some lifestyle changes of you know, what he ate and drank, if you will. You can read between the lines. The Strokes put him on a path of swimming at the YMCA and a more healthy lifestyle, but he couldn't write. It was over. And in a sense, the Strokes were a blessing. Now he had a medical
reason.
And he accepted it. So in the 5 years that I knew him, he was not frustrated. I mean, at a certain level, he was sad that he couldn't finish it. But, you know, he was content, finally. No more demons.
And then he talked to you about the possibility of carrying on what he had begun.
Well, over the years, and I learned to drop the subject finally, I'd say, Bill, you might want to consider someone.
Writing with someone.
Right. And he could be very melodramatic. He had a stentorian voice, and he would say, Paul, it would be like a mother giving away her child to be raised by another. And I'd say, well, Bill, if she doesn't, they're both going to die. And he'd say, nice try, Paul. But it was over. He did consider some folks, I guess, and things didn't work out. And I didn't consider that in 1999, if you will, 2000, my business. I didn't ask him who. I was just, you know, a pal, doing an occasional story. My daughter would come down with me from UMass, and they'd talk history. Bill used to call my little son Patrick, who was 8 at the time. And I dropped the subject, finally, of finding someone.
He had, in fact, seriously considered a number of people, one in particular, with whom he had telephone conversations, a great deal of correspondence. But then she became utterly frustrated with him.
See, I wasn't aware of that. He did mention her name once to me, and he mentioned that this conversation lasted maybe 8 seconds, that he just wasn't happy with what she was writing, and that she was making Londoners during the Blitz out to be victims, and he almost hissed that word, and he said they weren't victims, that they were heroes. And that's what he was looking for, the old sort of white hat, black hat, hero, villain. And that's the extent of what I know about that audition, if you will. And there were other names I didn't ask who they were, and a year or two went by, and the subject had been dropped until that October night in 2003.
When,
as usual, the Red Sox lost to the Yankees, and we were watching it at Bill's house. He was on his bed, I was in an armchair, and at the end of the game, he did allow himself one or two Jack Daniels on the rocks a couple of times a week. And he had had one during the game, and he shook the glass, and he said, could I have one more of these, please? And I went out to the kitchen and came back, and I had a glass of wine, and he said, could you go into my office and bring that suitcase out that's in there? And I said, okay. And I went in a big, heavy suitcase, and I could feel stuff moving around. And he said, please put it on the bed. And he unzipped it, and he turned to me and said, I'd like you to finish the book. Well, I told someone this yesterday. A few weeks earlier, I had a friend in West Palm Beach named Marvin Mounts, Judge Marvin Mounts. Marvin is the judge that Elmore Leonard based the character on in Maximum Bob, the hanging judge. Marvin loved William Manchester. And I said, Marvin, write him a letter or telephone him because he's old and ill and he likes to hear from people. And Marvin said, oh, no, he's William Manchester. I said, Marvin, call him. Well, he wrote him a letter and he introduced himself and told the Elmore Leonard story. So Bill sent his housekeeper out to get the entire Leonard canon, which was strewn around his bed that night with newspapers, and Maximum Bob, he had almost finished, and it was open on his bed to maybe within 10 pages of the end. And for one split second, it wasn't a coherent thought, I thought, oh, he wants me to finish Maximum. He wants me to read the book to him. And he could see that and he said, no, no, I want you to write the book. And then I understood.
And by the book, you knew.
The third volume. And in the suitcase were a dozen or so of his notes, some source material. He said, I want you to take this home and write 25 pages. It turned out to be 60 on the Blitz. And I packed up the suitcase. We went up to his office the next day at Wesleyan Library. I think he gave me some more information. And I went happily home thinking, I can do this.
What a monumental task this turned into.
Yes, it did. And it would have been for Bill, as were the first two volumes. It took him coming up on 5 years each. And I think if had he been healthy, this would have taken him 5 or 6 years. And, you know, for some reason, he thought it would take 2 years. Maybe he didn't want to discourage me. And so the publisher thought, oh, 2 years, 3 years. You know, the book will be out in 2007. Well, about 2 years into it, I said, this is going to take a while.
Did he say, we'll write this together?
He said, I'll never forget this, I took notes that night. He said, you write, I'll edit. I have my red pencils sharpened and ready to go.
Paul Reed, he's a journalist and now biographer. The book, The Last Lion. William Manchester's name is at the top. And Paul Reed, Winston Churchill, defender of the realm. And welcome back. Paul Reed is with me. He is a journalist. He took over the writing of the last volume of a biography of Winston Churchill from William Manchester. William Manchester had completed the first two volumes. He then became ill. He experienced writer's block to an horrendous dimension, and finally met by good fortune Paul Reed, a journalist from Miami.
West Palm Beach.
West Palm Beach, forgive me. And Paul took over the writing from the notes that William Manchester had given to him. Those notes were not terribly helpful.
No, I said in the author's note, they spoke to Bill Manchester in ways they couldn't speak to me.
How come?
Well, he created them. They were his baby, so he knew the system. And the system was, if the listeners can imagine, 2 8-and-a-half blocks of paper, 8.5 by 11-inch blocks of paper, sort of affixed together, so 50 pages each. So now you've got, in essence, a 100-page long tablet on which these 50 or 60 tablets, Bill would cut and paste Xerox excerpts from speeches and telegrams and memoirs and diaries, and they ran to, 5,000-plus pages, millions of words, and they were organized. They were basically chronological. Clump number 10 is about 1940, so will clump number 11, but not strictly chronological. So if you're looking for what happened at the Battle of Midway, it might have some information on clump number 29 and clump number 31 on page 52 of this one. And he had handwritten source and topic codes in the margins. The topic code for his doctor's memoirs was REX, or RX. The topic code for German politics was a swastika. The topic code for de Gaulle was a DEG. And he had source codes. Harriman's memoirs was HAR. Tragically, alas, the source codes disappeared. The key to the source codes. And there were hundreds of sources. So I knew what the topics were because I had the topic code key, but I didn't have the source code key for almost 2 years. And by the time I finally got it, they found it in the library, I thought I have to reinvent the wheel. I'll be looking through these long notes when I'm an old man, you know. So I pretty much reproduced all of the sources Bill Manchester used, and I got all of the speeches and all of the diaries and some new information from the Q archives, cabinet minute meetings or cabinet meeting minutes. And on 5 dining room tables arranged in a U, I just arranged everything and pretty much took each story, each week, each scene one at a time. And I'd move on to the next week. Well, some weeks, 5 or 6 things are happening. There's an invasion here and a bombing there and an assassination there. And so you go out 5 pages and then you've got to come back to the same week and do another story. And, but I found I could do it that way.
So he asked you to do this. How long did he live and how much was he able to provide guidance and that red pencil?
Well, he asked me on October 9th, 2003, and the next 3 or 4 months I worked on the 60-page audition. So now, and there wasn't much back and forth during that time. I was on my own. That was my assignment. So I guess it would be March that he liked what I had done, and Little Brown liked it, and his agent of 50 years and best friend Don Congdon liked it. And Don had absolute veto power. Didn't matter what Bill thought of it, Don had the veto power. That was in March, and by then Bill had bad stomach cancer, and I spoke to him on April 1st, his birthday, and there was no feedback. There was the red pencils remain sharpened to this day.
What was your audition material?
It was the Blitz. And he sent me home with, again, some memoirs and diaries and factual source material, population of London and the weight of a German bomber, that sort of thing. And he wanted, again, at first 25 pages, but then Don Congdon said, give me 60. On the start of the Blitz, which began September 7th in the late afternoon, 1940, and ran for, I think, 81 of the next 82 nights without a break. And I was telling a friend yesterday, 30 years ago, I was in London, and I was standing down near Westminster Bridge. It was near dusk, and I was just looking up the river, up the Thames Embankment, and an old Englishman came up to me, and he asked if I was lost or something. Very dapper. And I said, no, I'm just trying to imagine the German planes coming from what direction. And he pointed down the river, and he said they came from that direction. He had been a 19- or 20-year-old anti-aircraft battery operator in Hyde Park. And he said, come. And for 4 or 5 hours, we walked up Thames Embankment all the way to the East End, and he told the story as only a Londoner could. And he pointed out that on Cleopatra's Needle, the obelisk along the embankment, there are chunks missing from German bombs that the casual observer would never know that. And it was the most marvelous 5 hours. Mm. And when Bill asked me to do the Blitz, I have books in front of me and maps, but I had that old man's voice in my head, and I thought, I can do this.
And you did.
Yes.
The writing of the rest of the book, which we should say is about 1,000 pages, took you how long?
8 years.
And during that 8 years, how did you support yourself?
Well, in the broadest terms, the first couple of years with the advance and savings, and we had sold our house in Florida, which was an overheated market, and bought a smaller place up in North Carolina. And so the first 2, 3, 4, 5 years through our savings and the advance, and then we started using credit cards. Thank goodness. I recommend to all young listeners, keep your credit score above 800, because it'll come in handy someday. But there was no question of stopping. I was going to finish it, and we did what we had to do to support ourselves to finish the book.
So the publisher advanced money, but clearly it was not sufficient to carry you all the way through. You had to finance your own living expenses and subsistence by use of credit cards, by borrowing, by everything you could imagine just to get through this book.
Right. I mean, the job was going to get done by hook or by crook, and the estimate of 2 or 3 years at the beginning, you know, to this day, nobody knows where that came from. It was Bill Manchester tossed that out, and the publisher was very good over the years, Little Brown, because I have to believe, in fact, I know, in year 4 or 5, they're thinking, is this guy going to be able to do this?
Yeah.
And I'd send emails saying, don't worry. Well, you know, you hear that all the time. And they stuck with me. And then William Phillips, my editor, had retired from the top spot at Little Brown. And he came on board as my editor. In the first couple of years, there wasn't much going back and forth. But the last 4 years, we exchanged chunks of the book. And he was just absolutely marvelous. And he was firm and sometimes severe in some of his editorial comments, but it was all for the good. And without Bill Phillips, no book.
Paul, was there ever a point where you thought, you know, guys, this is more than I can do with both the means and the sources I have? I can't finish it.
No.
Never.
I think about that now, but if my wife or children would hear that, they'd say, no, he never thought that. I thought it would be done and done well, and I told Bill Manchester and Little Brown and Don Congdon that I'd never let them down. This was 9 years ago now. I said, I won't let you down. I won't let Churchill down. Well, you know, lofty words. I mean, I really didn't know what I was talking about then. But that was my goal, and I didn't let them down.
It's interesting. Here's a comment from a listener who's listening online, who says it was probably the Strokes that kept Manchester from finishing this book. But I have to wonder if Churchill's relatively sad post-war career, raging against the dying of the empire, mediocre to poor performance when back in office, and an intellect sufficiently undimmed to understand that this was the case may have made him, that is Manchester, not wish to finish it and sapped his will there too. For British people who lived then, there was a general sense that Churchill embodied Solon's recommendation to account no man happy until his death. Americans and others who didn't have to live under his government are generally more kind, remembering the Blitz alone.
Well, as far as William Manchester, he fought and fought and struggled to write that. And again, the strokes were a blessing in that he could end the struggle, because it wasn't going to happen, strokes or no strokes. He had finished writing, and then the strokes came, and he accepted in the following years that it was over.
Paul Reed, he is with William Manchester, the author of the third and final volume in the biography of Winston Spencer Churchill, subtitled Defender of the Realm, 1940 to 1965. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now, here is how closely some people who have already read this book are reading it. This is from Robert in Thomasville, Georgia. He says on page 363 and 364, Paul Reed recounts the sinking of the Bismarck. On page 364, he says, quote, Bismarck, its rudder jammed and unable to steer, was doomed. But Reed omits that the rudder was jammed by a torpedo dropped by a Royal Navy airplane flown from HMS Ark Royal. This is an odd and conspicuous omission, and I wonder why Reed chose to do this. He goes on to say, this is a wonderful book, entertainingly plowing new furrows in old fields.
Well, thank you for that. And I'm scanning the Bismarck page here, and I'm looking.
364 to 365. No, sorry, 363 to 364.
Well, I mean, I mentioned the torpedoes, gun shells. I mean, the Bismarck was getting hammered, and it was in trouble, and it
clearly
sank.
Clearly.
I know these very careful readers are out there, and I will do my penance and fix anything that done needs fixing.
Here's an email from Doug here in Washington, D.C. He says, I'm wondering if Paul could comment on Churchill's transition from being a liberal in his earlier career, including significant stints in high government positions, to his later becoming a conservative.
Well, before he became a liberal, he was a conservative. And then in English politics, it's called ratting when you switch parties. And he ratted to the Liberal Party. And during that decade, early in the 20th century, he was the uncle, if Lloyd George was the father, of many social insurance programs and welfare, unemployment insurance, broadly liberal policies, 20 years before Franklin Roosevelt would even dare approach the Congress with that sort of thing. But then Churchill switched back to the Conservatives. And as he said, I not only ratted, I re-ratted. But he was a liberal conservative. He was not a Tory's Tory, which is why the Conservatives didn't like him. They always mistrusted Winston because he had ratted, now he had re-ratted, and he had a liberal streak to him that engendered distrust among his colleagues.
And we'll take a short break here. When we come back, I'd really like to hear more about Churchill, the man, a person you call a natural leader with a searing wit and very little patience.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Angie's List, with local reviews of roofers, doctors, auto shops, and yard care. More at angieslist.com. By The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. And by Cancer Treatment Centers of America, a national network of 5 cancer hospitals dedicated to helping patients fight advanced stage cancer. More at cancercenter.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Hilary Mantel talks about her best-selling historical novel, Wolf Hall, and its recent sequel, Bring Up the Bodies, about the formation of the Church of England, the reign of King Henry VIII, and the beheadings he ordered. Each book won the Man Booker Award, Britain's highest literary honor. Join us.
Welcome back. Paul Reed is with me, and together with William Manchester, he has written the third and final volume, a biography of Winston Churchill, titled The Last Lion, Defender of the Realm, 1940 to 1965. Tell us about Churchill, the man. You say he was a natural leader with a searing wit and very little patience.
He was the sum of his contradictions. And you know, he's often seen or imagined as, and William Manchester did this too, as the last Victorian. He never carried cash. His train tickets were bought for him. He was of that class of Englishmen that where the everything set up to nurture and take care of them worked very well. His valet warmed his brandy snifter over a candle. The brandy in the house was Hein, probably bottled in the 19th century. He had very bad credit at the local stores. Not that he went shopping. He'd send someone down to bring home a ham and forget to pay. And the Churchills were in the neighborhood around Chartwell were not the best of neighbors as far as the merchants were concerned. He had never ridden the London Underground in his life, but once when he got on 1926 and got lost. It was like Charlie on the MTA, and his wife had to send, Clementine had to send out people to find Winston. He was just going, as she told her daughter, round and round and round. But I found he was far more than an old Victorian man. I see him as a classical in the Greek and Roman sense, as a descendant of Cicero and Plato and Ptolemy, and that's what he was. He wasn't a fuddy-duddy eccentric Victorian. He read Toynbee and he read all the 19th century histories and Gibbon and the Bible. He read the Bible cover to cover for cadence instruction for his speeches and what have
you. But he was not a religious man.
No, he was an atheist. And he had no respect, really, for the prelates of the Church of England or the Pope or anybody. He didn't begin his days with prayers or end them with prayers.
He did begin his days with a bit of alcohol.
Yes. And some of his old colleagues would like to say that he nursed one weak scotch and soda all day long, which is true. But he'd have a bottle of champagne at lunch and another at dinner and three or four brandies after dinner, maybe a contro between meals. It was a remarkable metabolism.
Paul, the volume begins, as I said, 1940 in May. Set the stage for us. Hitler was, as you write, at the top of his game.
Well, the French didn't want war. They weren't prepared emotionally, most importantly. They had a big army, the biggest in Europe, in the Maginot Line, which Hitler simply went around. England had a small army. England's a sea power, not a land power. They had an expeditionary force in France. And they knew it was coming all winter. And when it came, the French lack of preparedness, lack of spirit was evident, and a month later it was over in France on June 21st.
And yet Hitler expected the British to actually capitulate and accept his terms for peace.
He thought they'd be reasonable, because otherwise he was going to crush them. The French resented the fact that Churchill said, if you go down, we're going on alone. The French wanted the English to go with them. And in fact, asked Churchill for the final fighter planes that England had, a few squadrons of Spitfires and Hurricanes, and Churchill said, no, we're going to need them. They won't do you any good now. You've lost. And he saw that as a betrayal by the French.
You know, it's extraordinary because for almost a decade, you write that Churchill had drummed the warnings to his countrymen and really to the world about Hitler and Germany.
And his country, well, they were all veterans one way or another of the Great War. The slaughter was so unimaginable in 1914 to 18, any sane person wouldn't want to imagine it happening again. So they didn't use their imagination.
Didn't want to hear it.
Didn't want to see it, hear it. And for Churchill to be out there, it sounded like he was a warmonger. He wasn't. He was saying, this is what's going to happen.
But did he really believe that the Germans would invade England?
No, and this was one of the things I called Bill Phillips about toward the end of the book when we were in that section. I said, you know, there's a perspective here that I have to go with, and it's not me putting myself in the story or interpreting other sources. It's Churchill's words coming out of his mouth that summer of 1940, that he did the numbers, and the German merchant fleet, every barge, every boat, every tanker, every freighter, the Germans would have to use every ship they had to bring a modest force to England. They didn't have landing crafts. The Royal Navy would massacre it at sea at night. Churchill told the House this, the House of Commons. And he concluded this would be a one-shot deal for Hitler, and it would fail, and the war would be over, so it's not going to happen. Something else is, but not an invasion. But he called it the invasion scare, and it might appear cynical now to us, but he kept it up, talking about, you know, fighting on the beaches and fighting in the streets of London when they come, and all to build up offensive forces for the day when he could go back across the channel himself with modern landing craft and landing ships, and to keep the Americans in the game, even though they weren't in the war, to keep the Americans thinking, well, these British, they're not going to quit. But he never thought they were coming in the famous line about never have so many owed so much to so few, the few speech. That was simply a prelude to the root of the matter where he was going, which was to the bombing campaign he anticipated over Berlin. It was an aside, really, a thank you to the fighter pilots, but now let's get down to business.
At what point did he first approach FDR? At what point did he say, I need you?
That summer of 1940, even before France fell, they were in communication. But he asked for 50 destroyers. He needed fast escort ships. And it took months for him to finally get them from Roosevelt. He had to trade British territory for them, bases, naval bases. And when he got them, they were rust buckets. And his asides over dinner to some of his colleagues were not favorable. He thought Roosevelt was bleeding them dry to get the empire, if you will, without having to fight for it.
And yet, it would seem from our own understanding that the relationship between the two men was really very strong.
That, I think, is part due in part to Churchill's memoirs, where he writes of it as if it were. This is 10 years later. America's now the superpower. Let bygones be bygones, because during the war, oh, they exchanged gifts, and it was cordial, and Churchill wore Roosevelt out every time he went to the White House, the hours that he kept, and Harry Hopkins had to be hospitalized every time Roosevelt's right-hand man. Every time Churchill visited, everyone got ill and tired by the time he left. So it appears like a fun relationship. They watched Donald Duck movies and had dinners and took walks. They had a hot dog picnic at Hyde Park. But really, Roosevelt's agenda was to win the war in a way that the British Empire and the French, he didn't like the French at all, and all of the colonial powers would have nothing. His peace objective was the end of imperialism, which Winston didn't see. He was blind to that. You know, he thought, we'll get Singapore back, and the Americans will get Guam back, and their influence in the Philippines, and the British Empire will go on as before. And that was not Roosevelt's plan.
All right, let's go to the phones here to Indianapolis. Good morning, Rich. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks so much. There was a comment made by the author, I guess about 3 minutes ago, about the never have so many owed so much to so few. And I had always learned that that was a description of the Battle of Britain, the handful of Spitfires that used radar for a very decisive repulsing of the Luftwaffe. And I thought it might be interesting to have him clarify that, please.
The Spitfires didn't carry radar. The radar that year was much too big to put into the nose of an airplane.
Installations, understood.
Yes, the radar towers along the British coast, the sending towers and the receiving towers, the radar was the unknown hero there, that without the radar, there would have been major problems, and I should have mentioned that. But the comment Churchill made, the thank you, was to the Spitfire and Hurricane pilots, about 700 of each who went into the battle, and about 500 or 600 never came out of the battle. And it was a heartfelt thank you that resonates to this day. But his next sentence more or less says, now that we've taken care of that, let's get down to business. And it was about taking the offensive bombing campaign to Berlin. And a lot of histories, and Bill Manchester's draft of this ended with an ellipse. And I thought, what came after that? Well, what came after it, I thought was very important, that Churchill was thanking the fighter pilots, but his whole strategic vision is what came after that.
Very neat.
All right, sir. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Why is it so important to understand Churchill's view of the Mediterranean?
This was another perspective that I had a great time as dawn came. And again, this is from Churchill and from his generals, and I had to step back and think, and finally had something of a eureka moment that, my goodness, growing up in America, it was always the Normandy invasion and the Second Front, and Churchill didn't want to go to Normandy, and he talked about beaches running red with blood of dead soldiers and Hitler winning, and that's the way Hollywood and some popular historians have reduced the story to that. And pretty much immediately I realized, well, he calls the third volume of his war memoirs The Hinge of Fate, and it's about the Mediterranean. That was his hinge of fate. And I thought, why? Well, it was the lifeline between India and the Iraqi oil fields and Cairo and Malta and Gibraltar and London. It was all part of an organism, the torso, if you will, and if that is gone, the organism dies. The Cairo and Gibraltar and Malta were as important as the home island.
So basically, he saw the geographical makeup of the world, as it was, in a different way from those generals who were operating the Allied forces.
I wrote at one point that the Mediterranean, for Mussolini especially, and of course, and for Churchill, formed the four center squares of their chessboards, not for the Americans. The Atlantic, the Pacific, they had two chessboards at one point. But the Mediterranean was the key, and Hitler's admirals understood that. But Hitler and his generals did not, and they never took advantage of the English losses in the Mediterranean. They never closed the deal.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Tampa, Florida. Good morning, Denise. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Thank you so much. I would just like to comment about the very ambiguous attitude concerning Northern Ireland, because, of course, being part of the United Kingdom, there was no conscription there, but everybody who went was a volunteer, including my uncle, whose plane was shot down and he fell without a parachute and survived. However, there was always the attitude that Winston had some deal with the Irish Free State, so-called at that time, before it became a republic. Oh, well, let us use the ports, and we'll give you the north. Well, not even Winston could have handed over the north of Ireland, because he would have had great opposition to those who wanted to remain within the United Kingdom. And, in fact, Northern Ireland was central command for all of the Allied forces in Europe. And that is something I've never heard anyone say. I discovered it in a little booklet about the background of Ulysses Grant, whose great-grandfather came from there. And, in fact, Eisenhower used to ride around in his Jeep, apparently. Now, this was all before my time, and all I know is what I've been told, that talking about the bombings and the Blitz in London, people in Northern Ireland thought, oh, we'll never be bombed because the German planes could never go so far. And then there was a surprise when there was a residential area up by Dunkern Gardens in Belfast. It was beside the waterworks. And people thought, oh, well, he thought that was part of Holland and Wolff Shipyard, and that's why the German planes came to that area.
All right, Paul.
Well, I don't know exactly what you mean by central command. I mean, Ulstermen fought. General Sir Alan Brooke was one of 23 Brookes who fought in the First and Second World War. They were, you know, a warrior race, the Brooke family. But Churchill did, right around the time of Pearl Harbor, the Chamberlain government had given back to the Irish Free State those three ports you mentioned. Why they did that with war coming, who knows? It was one of their worst mistakes, and Churchill needed them, and he was willing to take them from Ireland by force if need be. And he did float the idea of a unified Ireland if the Republic came in on England's side as an ally, De Valera, that, you know, we can talk. Never went anywhere, but he was willing emotionally to let the North go.
Paul Reed with William Manchester. The book is titled The Last Lion, Winston Spencer Churchill, Defender of the Realm, 1940 to 1965. So much more to say. I wish we had time. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Diane.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Reed.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.